This is Chick Flick Fix. I'm Julia Scott.
And I'm AJ Knox.
We watch chick flicks and rom-coms and decide if they need fixing. Can we make them better or can we make them weird? This week, we're talking about Music and Lyrics from 2007. It was written and directed by Mark Lawrence. Every time I read it, I was like, Martin Lawrence? That's interesting. And it stars Hugh Grant and Drew Barrymore. Pretty much all of the best songs in this were written by Adam Schlesinger, who also worked on a ton of stuff, including some of the best songs on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and who very sadly passed away in April from COVID-19. I will say, maybe spoiler, that a few of the songs on the soundtrack still show up in my playlists at times.
That's fair. There are some real catchy earworms in this one.
It was really funny. My husband had watched it before, probably because I made him. And when the Buddha's Delight song comes up, he was like, wait, so this isn't a real song? This was just for the movie? And I was like, no, it's a real song, but yes, it was just for this movie. Because I guess he'd like heard it, you know, me playing it and dancing or something. Yeah. And been like, you know, it could have been a Britney song. And I was like, aside from the fact that I think she's in the sort of born again realm, but I guess a lot of that would be rebellious. I don't know, whatever. It was just really funny.
Yeah.
I mean, the songs are, and that really was like Schlesinger's absolute magical talent to be able, it's kind of funny, it strikes me now because I was about to say to like mimic or find the tone of something and copy it. And it's funny because they talk about that, like she's accused, the female character is accused of being a super talented mimic by her professor or ex-professor. But that he was so incredibly good at being able to capture the sense of like a genre, or in some cases like a specific artist or song even, so that you're like, yeah, no, I'm there, and it's still a good song. Because this movie, if the songs had been even just like meh, like, you know, placeholder songs to be like, this is the kind of music that they did,
yeah,
I mean, this movie would have been intolerable.
Yes. I could get on board with that argument.
So you hadn't seen this, right? Because you were apprehensive when I suggested it.
I was apprehensive mainly from the poster, which looks, I mean, it is as rote of a movie poster as you could find. It's like if you were to Google...
The actors could be replaced with any others, like Jack Nicholson and Diane Keaton.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, interchangeable love interest number one and two.
I mean, even the title font, the bold sans serif with the all lowercase serif font is like, it. Everything about it just screams like factory processed in a way that I was very apprehensive about.
Was it as horrible as you feared?
I will save my...
Yes and no?
I will save my judgment for a little bit, but you'll probably be able to hear my opinion in my voice.
So, what is this movie about?
When you think of the biggest bands of the 80s, you think of pop.
I said I wasn't gonna lose my head, but then pop goes my heart.
Did you ever hear of the band Pop?
Yeah, of course. Everybody has. They had that ridiculous hair and those ridiculous outfits, and oh my God, you're one of them.
I can't lose this.
Alex Fletcher has one last shot at fame.
The show is called Battle of the 80s Has-Beens.
We did actually break up in 1992, so technically I'm a 90s has-been.
All he needs...
Cora Corman, bigger than Britney and Christina put together.
...is a hit.
I can't possibly write a hit song for her by Friday.
Get it up, I'm a bad heart witch.
No. But with some magic, I just might switch.
I would love to talk to you about maybe writing some lyrics.
I'm just here to cater to the plants.
That one is plastic.
I met that guy from that band you used to like. He invited me to come see him perform tonight.
Gary, I'm going out! Oh my God!
Now, girls, be honest. Are these pants too tight?
All right, so Music and Lyrics stars what has become my favorite version of Hugh Grant, which is Hugh Grant playing the washed-up has-been. For reference, I would also direct listeners to Paddington 2, where he plays like a washed-up actor, and it is incredible. I think this is like the kind of role he's born to play.
And it's funny because in About a Boy, he's also like someone living off one song, right, in that case that he didn't even write. But
yeah, and I like him in that too. Like I've realized now that the movies I enjoy Hugh Grant in the most are these movies where he's kind of a washed up, you know, one trick pony has been. Anyway, so he plays a has been who is being approached to be on this, on a new reality show called Battle of the 80s Has Beens, which is just such a great fake TV show. And he thinks it's a songwriting show or a music show like American Idol. And it's no, actually a fighting show. Where the winner gets to perform. It's a boxing show where the winner gets to perform.
And they're like, Debbie Gibson, Tiffany, Flock of Seagulls, Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Yeah, and as they're rattling off this whole list of 80s, famous 80s icons, after each one, he just says one word from their titles or from their names. Like, oh, Debbie, Frankie, Flock.
Or, oh, their sister.
As if he knows all of them. So he's like very subtly name dropping that whole time. Anyway, so he and his manager, Brad Garrett, are kind of struggling to find the next thing. And while they're struggling to find the next thing, in the weirdest meet cute I've ever seen in a movie, Drew Barrymore shows up as his replacement plant lady because his regular plant lady is sick or, you know, can't make it.
Later, she just says away for a non-specified amount of time.
Yeah. So Drew Barrymore, her job, presumably, is to go to people's houses and water their plants. Gardener is one thing, but internal apartment houseplant watering is like its own very specific kind of job.
I bet there are people who do that just for people who have just enough money to. Because I also like how they justify why he has all these plants but needs help with them.
Because
plants make women comfortable.
Yeah, some woman once told him that plants make women comfortable, so he now has plants in his apartment that he doesn't know how to take care of.
And she immediately hurts herself.
Yeah, she immediately hurts herself in a very weird way that I thought, oh, is she a spy? Is she, like, sent by the people from the Battle of the 80s Has-Beens? Because she's there for about 30 seconds before she stabs herself on a cactus, freaks out, and leaves in a really panicked rush.
And it's weird because she talks about being... I love that she says she's hypochondriacal, not a hypochondriac, but it, like, never comes up again.
Right, right.
So it's not like this is a quirk that's going to be a thing throughout the movie, which you think at first.
Nope.
It's just gone. The same as with she, every time she comes into the apartment, she like, you know, takes off her bag and her coat and tries to place them on the piano and he catches them before they reach the top of the baby grand. And it's like, part of me is like, I like that that's a little detail.
Yeah.
But then it should maybe also be clear, like, is this because he's generally anal retentive? Like, he doesn't like her moving his furniture? Or is it just like the baby grand is the one thing that he has left?
Right, so that you can't touch it. Yeah, absolutely. And I totally agree with you. There's a lot of those weird little like character details in this movie that point to kind of time and attention that didn't need to be paid in a movie like this, which is kind of fun. Anyway, so Hugh Grant, Alex Fisher, is the reason he's an 80s has-been, he was part of a big group called Pop. He's like the forgotten member of Pop. From the 80s.
Pop exclamation point, which of course bears no resemblance to Wham! Exclamation point.
No, none at all. And so he gets called over to meet with the rising young star Cora, who is kind of like a space alien in human form. And she's also way into cultural appropriation and all these kind of like problematic elements of her music. But she's essentially kind of like the Christina Aguilera, Britney Spears, early Christina, early Britney kind of surrogate. You know, she's the rising pop star and she wants to collaborate.
And I feel like she also, like, she takes parts of Madonna trying on new personalities, religions, philosophies, like every, yes, I don't know, 19 to 27 months or so.
Yeah, absolutely. She's got like these different personalities. Anyway, so she wants to collaborate on a new song. Hugh Grant goes back to work on it. He's, you know, he's in between gigs at Knott's Berry Farm and state fairs. And he's not a lyricist. And while Drew Barrymore is there taking care of the plants, she kind of chimes in and you realize, oh, she's a really good lyricist. She's kind of a preternaturally gifted lyricist. So, of course, they collaborate. As the movie goes along, they have their arguments about like the meaning of making music and what the importance of music or lyrics and lyrics, whatever, could be. At a certain point, they give Cora their recording of their song, which is they think is great. It's a very sweet duet. And she turns it into like a weird sex Buddha song. And that causes a big fight between Hugh Grant and Drew Barrymore. Drew Barrymore decides to run away to Florida, where he says, and she's like, I guess I just need to go to Florida and grow up. And he says, nothing grows up in Florida except an orange, which is just a dumb line, but I loved it. Oh, I missed a crucial part of these characters. Drew Barrymore was the subject of a novel or of a book by her former professor who she was having an affair with. And it was kind of a slandery kind of subject, and she's embarrassed about it. And Hugh Grant embarked on a solo attempt, and he's been visiting the Tower Records by his apartment to see if anybody's bought the last CD of his solo album, and it has never sold. You find out that they each consumed the media from the other, and then they use it as weapons against each other because they're mad about this new song. Hugh Grant wants Cora to just do it because he needs the money and the fame. And Drew Barrymore is all about the integrity of the art. They kind of have a falling out. They've already slept together, so there's already romantic entanglement. At the end of the movie, Drew Barrymore and her sister, who is delightfully played by Kristen Johnson from Third Rock from the Sun, and her sister and her nieces and nephews and, you know, brother-in-law, they all go to Madison Square Garden to see this Cora concert where Hugh Grant will be singing with her. Drew Barrymore doesn't want to go in. They introduce the song. She finally goes in. They introduce the song as written by Alex Fletcher, but not by Sophie Fisher. They don't introduce her name. She gets mad. She's storming out of the concert. He starts playing a song. It's not the song they wrote. It's a song about her. He's finally been able to write lyrics, and they're quite charming. And she cries. She runs backstage. They smooch. And then Cora begins her song, but she's now going to do it the way it was intended because Hugh Grant had a little convo with her and told her how much it meant that she'd do it the right way. So Cora goes out and does her song. Hugh Grant goes to join her. Earlier in the movie, she said the song was unfinished and he needed to finish the last verse. And they're about to sing the last verse, Hugh Grant and Cora. And then Hugh Grant runs off stage and kisses Drew Barrymore again.
Which seems like a douchey thing to do since Sophie had sent in the lyrics for the last verse.
But I think the point of it was the song didn't matter anymore, just his love for Sophie. And then in what is maybe the most clever version of the after movie Where Are They Now bit, they show the same 80s music video that they showed at the very top of the movie from the band, from the fake band Pop. But now it's kind of a pop-up video, and it is all about where are all the characters now, but in the context of you'd be watching this and getting information about Hugh Grant's character in this pop-up video. It was very clever.
It was.
Anyway, that's the movie. I really liked it. I went in ready to hate it, and I really liked it.
You know what I realized? And I, like, just now, because I was joking before about, like, some things come up over and over again. It's like Sex and the City and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And I realized, because when we watched 27 Dresses, we said, like, it's written by someone who knows all the elements and then just kind of loses it because it was too mean. Yeah. This feels like it's written by some... It has this same sort of very sort of soft, irreverent touch, but it's written by someone who loves the element, knows the elements, and it's like kind of... It's not that deep. And that's what makes it good.
Yeah.
And it's just the right level of earnest. It doesn't take itself too seriously, but it's also not too ironic about it. It's just like, this is fun. Love is great. Also, the music and the music videos.
Yeah.
I'm there for it.
Yeah. You're right. It is 100% shallow. And that, I think, is so to the movie's credit because it's not trying to be a big grandiose thing. It's not trying to be more meaningful or important. It's fluff. And it knows it's fluff, and it embraces that.
And it's quality fluff.
Yes, absolutely. It's quality fluff.
And that is because when you know what you're doing and you're confident that you can do it well, and you don't have huge pretensions about it. It's like the movie has found the balance between Alex's and Sophie's view of creating culture. Like, yes, it can be a formula, but there can also be something there that you care about.
Yeah. I mean, and this was literally just like the lightest, easiest, most, it was cotton candy, you know?
Yeah. But it was good cotton candy. It's not like, you know, the plastic tub that's been sitting in a warehouse for 2 years. It's freshly made.
This is, you go up to the vendor, it spins it right there for you. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just like, it makes me happy. And clearly, I, you know, love, appreciate, and respect Adam Schlesinger's work. And it's like, how do you manage to find... And like, because with some movies about music, you're like, yes, this is fun, but I don't actually care if there's a whole song that I can listen to.
Yeah.
And these, they're just so good. Like, Way Back Into Love, it kind of, the songs also manage to, kind of like when we were talking in Dirty Dancing about being bad at singing or dancing or whatever, here they very much match what they sort of would be actually. So like Way Back Into Love is when you have a composer and a lyricist, they're not totally comfortable with each other yet. She's like, but it's, you know, it's a quality song. It could probably use a couple more weeks work.
Mm-hmm.
And his song at the end is like, yeah, you're not a lyricist, but this is very cute. You tried. You've killed all my plants. Like, it's cute. It's funny. It's not awesome. Pop Goes My Heart. You're like, yes, I could see how that could be on all the charts in like 1984 or five.
Well, and Pop Goes My Heart, like, has all these like great 80s references kind of musically built in. Like, even some of the refrains, like, I kept hearing, like, I was working, you were working as a waitress in a cocktail bar. Because it has that kind of 80s, like, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, that they love to do.
There's a song that he performs briefly on stage called Meaningless Kiss. I don't know if you've listened to it, like, on Spotify.
No.
But it is an amazing take on, wait, now I have to remember what the actual song is, but the Wham song, Careless Whisper. Such a perfect pastiche of Careless Whisper, because it has the same, like, very synthetic sax melody running in the background, and it's just all of it's done with, again, like, the knowledge and love of being able to just pinpoint exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And also, Buddha's Delight is just such a bizarre song, but it's so fun to dance to, and it's like, especially, like, once when you really do listen to the lyrics, and you're like, okay, somebody actually, like, Googled stuff about, you know, about this religion, and then just kind of shoved it in a song, and then wiggle, wiggle, wiggle.
I think, like, chorus songs are so kind of atrocious, but in the way that you're like, yeah, this would sell. Like, I get it.
Yeah, and it's funny, because for a while you're like, well, what would they expect if they gave this song to Cora? Of course she's going to do her own thing with it.
Yeah.
And then maybe you could be like, well, it is weird that she sings that at the end. But I think at the end, it's partly that she's a romantic. And she's a romantic in the sense that you are when you're that age, when, you know, breaking up with your boyfriend of 2 months is a huge thing. And, like, she's like, win them back. But I also think that that song is the one where she, like, you know, pulls on a glittery hoodie over her tiny little outfit and sits down at a piano.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, all of the stage lights go down and she does her, like, this is my slow feelings song. She maybe doesn't even actually press the keys, like, they've been dampened entirely.
Right.
But, like, because you have the sort of, you know, not a girl, not yet a woman, or beautiful, or what, like, those, like, at one point in that concert with the fire and the dancing and the wiggling, you're going to have, like, okay, this is where we all slow down. This is possibly when, like, the accompanying parents can go out to get, like, another beer or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's still, like, it fits in with that, too. I feel like we're already, like, so far in the movie, we've talked about all the components. So I feel like the trope is basically, like, two people discover their talents, that they can do things.
Yeah, but it's also the I don't know what you'd call it, maybe like the puzzle piece trope, right? Where it's like each one is missing, like, needs what the other one is contributing.
Together they're greater than the sum of their parts.
Yeah, because he's a musician who cannot write lyrics. She's a writer who doesn't know how to make music.
And also, like, the kind of stuff she writes, like, if you look at the poetry that we see briefly on, like, her, on that Lit magazine, it's not stuff that is going to be too successful as poetry.
Right.
But it can be really great lyrics.
Yeah, yeah.
Plus, I love music movies. We've established this beyond.
Yes.
So, the main couple.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like so many episodes are me banging on about age differences, but I feel like here, because they bang on so much about how old Alex is, and like the band, so many jokes about hip replacements and the pop-up videos at the end.
Yes.
And like, if we just go off, you know, when he was big, but also like when these actors are born, Hugh Grant's character is in his mid to late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Drew Barrymore is in her early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that age difference matters less once one of you is in your 30s, but like that, they have such different experiences of the 80s.
Right.
And he, you know, we get some hints of the stuff he's done, and we can imagine because he was, you know, famous. And also he I think has not done a lot of emotional work on himself.
No.
So like, I don't think he's that fun to live with. Then again, she's also not that emotionally mature, so maybe they'll help each other.
Yeah, I mean, when
grow up,
when we see her babysitting her niece and nephews, they're just playing Dance Dance Revolution literally until her sister and her husband get home, and then she's like shoves them into bed.
Hey, fun auntie. It's a good place to be.
Yeah.
But I think it's also good because they, like, we mentioned some of their tiny quirks, but I like that neither of them is that quirky, because both Drew Barrymore and Hugh Grant have a part that they're often sort of shoved into,
mm-hmm.
of being both of them kind of stammery, clumsy.
Mm-hmm.
And here they're not. Like, he's, you know, a little worn in, and she's just mostly just like a regular person. You know, like, oh, yeah. she had like literary aspirations. She got treated badly by a man and lost them, and maybe wasn't that passionate about them. Who knows? And then she's like going to go to Florida and grow up. But they're just like, they feel like people.
Yeah. Yeah. They feel very genuine. They feel very, I mean, and maybe that's to the movie's detriment, right? Like maybe they're a little too kind of vanilla.
Mm-hmm.
And don't have that same kind of quirky charm that a lot of people tend to associate with them. But I think for this movie, at least for me, like, it worked. Like, it allowed me to kind of connect with them as people in a way that I probably wouldn't have if they were more broadly drawn caricatures.
I think what kind of complicates it for me is that it makes a little clash because they feel like such real people. The moment when they have like their big conflict and Alex is really, really cruel to her.
Ooh, yeah.
Feels more painful. Like if it had been a quirkier movie and like they had done more quirky sparring, it that would be like, oof, but it's a movie moment. But the way it is now, because you're like, I could hang out with, like, I could know these people. When he's like, everything that is written about you in that book is true. And this is like, you know, the grand actual life trauma in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not one of those traumas where the viewer is like, well, get over it. It's like, that is literally very painful. And he's like, everything that you think about yourself when you wake up at 3 a.m. is true. Like, he, I don't know, like, just super painful. And that becomes worse because it feels like such a vanilla friendly movie and they feel like real people.
Yeah.
Cause I mean, other than that, like I love, cause they have all these like little funny moments. Like when he's, cause they joke about his pants a lot and she says something about you're very sensitive for someone who wears such tight pants, and he says, they force all the blood to my heart.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so funny. And when they talk about music being sticky and steamy, he's like, it's both sticky and like, it's just these little things. So it has a lot of that charm, but I don't know if I would say like it would need more charm and weirdness, but that moment is like, I don't know if I could come back from that. If someone said to me, like, you know, every mean blog comment, every mean review of one of your books or whatever
mm-hmm. was right,
everything is true, I, especially someone that I barely know, but who's like, I read this about you. Or, you know, like if someone was like, I met with all the people who don't like you and I agree with everything. Like, you know, it's just, that's, cause when she says, cause you said that they take in each other's media and then use it to hurt each other. She just says like, this was good, but you didn't try hard enough.
Right.
That's not quite as harsh.
Yeah,
you know?
he says that this book, and previously in the movie they see the author of the book, and he ends up kind of attacking the guy physically in a restaurant,
which I think is a really funny scene, could feel a bit too much Hugh Grant, but it's like where he's like, very much like the theme of that whole scene and the following is like, I saw that going differently.
Yeah,
because you can tell he's probably never been in. At least definitely not a sober fight.
Right. And that scene when they meet him at the restaurant and Drew Barrymore gets all tongue-tied, that's like the little moment of kind of classic Drew Barrymore, I think, that people, think of her as that kind of comic actress.
But that also feels very real and true. Like, she has the speech perfectly prepared of what she would say to him.
Yep.
And then she comes up to him and is like,
And she because starts making
that
noises.
Is what would happen. Like I could feel that.
Yeah,
this movie has a really fun, like, gallery of secondary characters. Mm-hmm. Like the sister, I love her because she's wonderfully played, but also just like that character of like, because she is more of a contemporary of his. She loved him when she was a teenager. Mm-hmm. She flips out.
Oh my God.
When she hears that Sophia's met him, and then she like fits perfectly into this, like, I don't know, lascivious throng of women in front of all his performances
at the high school reunion where his mm-hmm. gig is at the 87 high school reunion,
and he pulls something in his hip.
Yep,
because hips, and like the manager is lovely. Cora is, like you said, she's just played like this weird mannequin alien person thing. And that's not a diss on the actress. It's just like, it's well done. And
she's so strange.
Yeah. And you could see that, like, you know, child stars, they get weird.
Yeah. But she just has this like emotionless expression on her face all the time. And this very monotone, calm way of speaking whenever she talks, mm-hmm. and a lot of pauses, and it's just very unsettling.
That was really creepy when you did that.
It's so good with the way she does it. Yeah, I agree. I think like all those side characters, Brad Garrett's really fun as the manager,
and the briefly the other lyricist that they bring in briefly, who's like all about the dark lyrics and doesn't like, but he's at Cora's concert.
Yeah.
He's really well played. And I kind of like that, because we have her former professor is like a brief antagonist, but really the antagonist is kind of the book and her feelings around it. Like, he's not actually that important.
Yeah.
And then it's like the antagonist is time. You know, like, because there's just like time is running out to do to like get the song delivered and then like have it recorded and be able to convince Cora in time, because they're like, you know, it has to be delivered by Friday and then she's going to perform on whatever it is Tuesday, which is also, I always find it funny when movies like this have a very specified time frame, when it makes it obvious, it's like, oh no, they fell in love in 4 days, which, you know, they spend so much time together, I could see it happening. It's just funny when you go back and you're like, this whole movie was like less than a week.
Yeah and the time frame is just kind of there to give it some urgency for them. And I don't even know that the villain is time so much as it, like, because honestly I think part of it is the whole movie is them kind of reckoning with their past. Like, Hugh Grant just wants this song to be performed and accepted and sung. He doesn't really care how, and he comments throughout the movie like, oh, like, what inspired you to write that? He goes, oh, the paycheck, or, you know, whatever. He has all these comments about how he takes the jobs because he needs the money.
Well, also, like, I think because, you know, he's written a lot of songs, Mm-hmm. So one individual song being, you know, mangled or remixed doesn't matter that much to him. But this is her first song, so of course it's going to mean something to her. And also, she, you know, she's sleep deprived at this point.
Yeah.
So it's not that he's cynical. It's just that, like, his you know, level of involvement and, like, engagement and passion for this is just by value of experience and investment per piece is going to be way different than hers.
Right. And yeah, so it is that kind of, like, they both just have different ideas about what the important aspects of this song are and what's worth fighting about and what's worth fighting for.
And I like when they talk about, you know, both sort of music and culture, like, the music is the sex and the lyrics are they getting to know them, or mm-hmm. is it dinner or dessert? And it's just, it's kind of cute how they are both just kind of dealing with what are my thoughts on, yeah, like, art, kind of. Like, it's, yes, it's not that deep, but in a way it is deep. Because you have, like, an 80s pop star has-been, very specific kind of experience,
mm-hmm.
and a painfully failed, you know, creative writing student.
Yeah.
They're going to come into it so differently. And it's, like, not just, they don't only complete each other for producing work. I think it's also, like, they maybe complete each other for the stuff that they haven't been able to find or have been pushing away. Like, not necessarily, like, he needs to settle down, she needs to lighten up, mm-hmm. but a little bit, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, they do have that kind of, well, they do introduce the opposites attract idea, right? With
mm-hmm.
she's quirky and she comes in and is putting her stuff on the piano and he's really fastidious and you know, kind of anal about his space. I mean, there's that whole scene where she wants to write the lyrics and they keep moving the piano and moving the furniture so that she can get close enough, but he can also feel like he has enough space. And so there's a lot of that, like, the conflict of who's in whose space, and she's the little bit more chaotic force, he's a little bit more ordered force, right? He likes, which is kind of weird because you think, like, in most movies about, like, old rock stars, they're the chaotic, you know.
Well, it's probably because, like, he was always the other guy in pop. He didn't have the successful, yeah. So he hasn't quite had the same chance to be as chaotic. And also, she is very much a little sister.
Yeah. Well, I also like the, speaking of pop, that just reminded me of when they are introducing, at the very beginning, the movie opens with the 80s music video, which is pretty well done. Like, definitely, like, ticks all the boxes of an 80s music video. And then it cuts to, like, a Where Are They Now? And it's all about Colin, who is the lead singer of pop. And they talk about all the things he's done. He's like,
who the other guy was?
Started a perfume line. And his scent line, which is Whiff of Colin, which is so close to Whiff of Colin. And I know that had to have been intentional. But I think it's like, you do get the sense that, like, after that, of course, he's just kind of the quiet, forgotten one from pop. Until the sister, Kristen Johnson, discovers that he exists. Because she's a super fan.
Which is so cute. She's like, Gary, I'm going out! She just runs away.
She's,
you know, she's like at the back of her closet trying to find the spangliest thing she owns.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is she your favorite character?
I remember watching Third Rock from the Sun growing up and thinking she was so funny. She was always kind of everyone really loved French Stewart on that show.
No, I loved her more.
He was playing the really weird alien. But she just had this, it's been so long since I've seen the show, but there's a part of me that wants to say, like, maybe, like, her alien was, like, the patriarch of the alien family. And
because they're aliens, and it's not, like, necessarily she's a man stuck in a woman's body. So, like, all of the complaining about women's bodies doesn't feel as gross as it could have in, like, other sort of gender switch. She's just, because
it's the human bodies.
Probably the patriarch could have just as well ended up in, like, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's body and been like, what the hell is this squeaky voice, you know?
Right.
But yeah, no, she just does the patriarch / sexy woman really well. And she's just, it's really good.
Yeah, she's it made me realize, like, I want her in more things. Like, she is so funny, and she's got such a good... She's got a style of comedy that you don't see often in women who do comedy as their, like, kind of primary acting.
I think it's that she is very good at finding the balance and switching between, like, hyper-realistic, I know. Like, when she does the, oh, no, you're fine, you're a guest, which is, like, it's so funny. And you're like, yeah. I've sat at that table. I've 100% sat at that table with that mom.
Yes.
And then when she switches into the bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that she's like goes from funny to like straight man. It's that she just switches so that the absurd becomes even more absurd. She's really good at that, I think, especially here.
Yes. And she's like that. She's that comic actor who can turn on a dime and still be like doing comedy at the same level on each point, right? And so I feel like she is just so damn funny in this movie. As soon as I saw her name in the opening credits, I was like, oh, I'm excited. So I think she's probably my favorite character. Well, is Kristen Johnson your favorite character too?
I think so. If I can't count like Pop the Band as my favorite character. Yeah. Then just because like she's not in it a lot, but she's also like, I do hate that she has a weight loss company, but whatever, they inherited it from their parents. She's just like, she's a sort of grounding element, and I really like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think I have a least favorite because there are so few people in this.
Yeah, it's a small cast, so it would be hard to find a least favorite character. And really, I think... I mean, by default, is the least favorite character the professor guy that wrote the book?
I mean, he could kind of lift right out because she could sort of try to get her revenge some other way. He's not that important, but he's not huge enough that he's just like, he's a bit of a butt.
Yeah, I don't think I have a least favorite character. I think it goes because all the characters, it's such a tight cast, so it's, and there's no real villain, there's no real kind of 80s crummy villain. I was anticipating Colin showing up at some point as like
just to antagonize
douchey,
him like
yeah, the douchey antagonist, like in the full 80s bully jock kind of way. But that never happened.
No. What's your favorite part?
Oh.
For me, the favorite part is Love Autopsy.
That's pretty good.
Because he's like, you know, he talks about how this was such a crappy lyric. Or he did a really bad rhyme with Love Autopsy. And the other lyricist is like, you couldn't save that. And she just, and they just click in this, because they have the same kind of silliness and the same kind of like, this is how we write. And it, again, like... Because they're like, it doesn't have to be that deep. That is sometimes how you actually find the deep and the weird metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's possible that what I'm doing is making it too deep when I'm having my not too deep discussion about,
no,
about this
I think,
movie.
I think that you can infer deepness, you can infer depth on this. I'd say...
And you know what? Shallow water heats up faster than deep water.
That's so profound. true. But deep water is full of eels.
Okay. Do eels?
This has been Water Flix Fix. where we talk about bodies of water. I don't know if I have like a specific favorite part. I have my favorite joke in the movie. After they sleep together and they fall asleep under the piano. And in the morning, the phone rings and Hugh Grant wakes up with a start and hits his head on the piano. And you hear like this musical kind of clang and he goes, oh, and then he goes and answers the phone. Then he's on the phone with Brad Garrett and he's like, I don't know. I slept with her last night. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And then you just hear quietly in the background, you hear clang. Ow. He goes, I've got to go.
No, Sophie's I think she's up.
and I just think like. That's an example to me of a filmmaker finding a way to use the medium of film to get a good joke in, right? Because I think so often in rom-coms, what you're relying on for the jokes is dialogue or situation. And sometimes you don't get those. I think Edgar Wright does this amazingly where he does like the off-screen or just off-screen jokes. And you don't see those a lot. And so when that happened, I was so delighted by the movie. It like caught me so by surprise because it was a stronger joke than I thought the movie had in its arsenal.
Yeah. And it's also like, if you think about it, it also implies a ton of other things as well. Like, you know, they started kissing and they just, you know, started doing it. And I'm kind of like, maybe, you know, because it's like if you get up to move to the bedroom in certain situations, that will, you know, kill the vibe, or you'll start looking at each other and thinking. And also, he has a waterbed. Cannot recommend. Right. So it's just like everything is way easier. I do love that they have like the subtle nonverbal waterbed jokes because he's stuck in the 80s.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that weird thump string clang thing. It's just, it's good. You're right. That is very good.
This is my favorite joke.
Is there... I mean, my least favorite part, maybe obviously, is when he just lashes out in that horrible way. But I don't know how you would change that necessarily. Like, I don't know if that's maybe part of my fix. Like, maybe he could just say, like, you're way too hung up on this and be, like, a little bit mean about that. Because, again, like, I don't know how you actually come back from that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, to me, I was like, well, that's part of the narrative of a rom-com is I think you've got to have that, like, forced conflict a little bit, but...
Yeah, you have to have your darkest moment, but it can look different ways, you know?
Yeah. For me, my least favorite part is much less important, but it's when they... it's right after that, and she's sitting in the park eating a sandwich.
Oh, yeah.
And it falls apart while she's eating it, and I was like... So you broke up so you don't know how to eat anymore?
Everything's falling apart.
Because
and it's badly acted, too.
It's so badly acted. The way she's holding the sandwich, she's holding it. It's like a pita wrap. And she's holding it literally with
by the very edges.
By the very edges. And I'm like, nobody has ever held a sandwich like that. Ever. And then it all falls down and she kind of makes this grand, like, oh God, everything's so difficult. And it reminded me of all like the black and white infomercial fails of like people who just can't
that
like,
is so true.
Can't put away their Tupperware.
That is so amazingly true. And it's like, don't take the paper off. Good Lord.
Yeah. Don't fully unwrap your sandwich and then hold it daintily at the edges.
With your tiny little crab pincers. That is, oh, you're right. God. That can definitely lift right out.
Yeah, that's my least favorite part.
What, we've talked a lot about the end, and I'm like, it's very unprofessional of him to just run off stage before the end of the song. Because you think he's running off to like get her on stage and like she can sing the last verse or something.
No, just but going for a smooch.
Yeah, but I do... I love how bizarre the concert is. And it's, like I said, it's just exactly what it would be. And I love the incredibly cheesy thing of her, of when they say written by Alex Fisher, you're just like, oof, like right in the heart.
Yeah.
And then like she almost makes it out of the arena, but hears it. And the song is just cheesy. And I love the pop-up video. It's just good.
Yeah.
It's good.
And you know what I actually really like about the concert as he's singing this song effectively to her, knowing that she's in the audience, knowing that they have this fight and it's like an apology and also a, this is how much you mean to me and I'm putting myself out there because I'm not a lyricist, but I'm doing this anyway, is he doesn't see her in the audience.
He doesn't look at her.
In a lesser rom-com, the spotlight would land on her somehow. They would know where she was and she'd rush up onto the stage. But no, the song ends and then she has to run over to the bouncer and try to get backstage, and only because she's already worked.
Yeah, because with Cora. There's no guarantee that she would be there. He's just like, I need to get to do this. And he's sort of talked Cora into it. I also love when he does his little like hip thing when they're singing together.
Yes.
Because like he couldn't get the choreography early. I love that tiny little choreography moment when everybody else is just like slithering around and he's just trying to do his little vroom vroom hand motions. It's just really cute. Like she does a shimmy on stage and he does his weird pop move. It's a nice ending.
It is. It's a charming, it's exactly what a rom-com chick flick ending should be, right?
Yeah.
Sweet, heartwarming, inoffensive. Yeah.
You want to hear something really funny?
Go for it.
This has the exact same Rotten Tomatoes ratings as Pretty Woman.
Interesting.
63% fresh from critics, 68% from audiences. It has a 6.5 on IMDb, which is a little bit lower, but not that much.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which is funny because I think, of course, I've forgotten what I gave Pretty Woman, but I feel like I would, in certain ways, rate this higher in that it is quality fluff.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily a better movie, but for what it is, it's good. Do you know what I mean? Like, for what it is. And also, it didn't make me, like, angry at men and the world in the same way that Pretty Woman
does. And I think, like, that idea. So, I mean, we've talked a lot on this podcast about how, you know, some movies are, well, how most of the movies we watch are problematic in some way, shape, or form, either about their attitude or stances towards women or towards BIPOC individuals or, you know, any or LGBTQ characters, right? Like, there's so many ways that these movies can kind of tank. And I think, like, we may just take it with a little grain of salt that, like, yes, this movie is too white, like 100%. And that's my biggest fault against it. And I'm coming to the realization that a lot of chick flicks are going to be too white, too problematic, you know.
Well, because they are cis, hetero, white, thin,
yes,
Western.
Yes.
Because they're meant to be aspirational and we don't have the imagination to see anything else as aspirational. And you get that bizarre and annoying paradox of like, well, we can't sell that. And then they never make that, whatever it is that's not that within BS, that.
Yeah.
That sucks. Yeah. And we try to find some of the few outliers to do every now and then.
Oh, absolutely.
Like that is just like a permanent disclaimer. Like, yes, it's a very white movie.
Yeah. Like, that's kind of what I was thinking about with this one. I was like, that's my biggest knock against it but that's my biggest knock against pretty much everything most of the movies we watch is I want them to be more inclusive. But
again, this movie doesn't slut shame Cora ever.
Yeah, that's true.
They're like, true. It's kind of weird that she's singing about Buddha and writhing about, but there's never a comment about, like, the way she dresses or anything, which
that's
I kind of appreciate.
That's actually a really good point.
Because they could really easily, either from, you know, either of the main characters or someone else, like, the closest we get is the mom being a little annoyed that the dad and the young son are fascinated by her. But
gyrations.
But even so, like, that's just, she's like, okay, this was, you know, I thought it was rated G and it's not, you know, like that thing. That is the only thing. And I appreciate that, especially in a movie that came out when it did. Because a lot of, I think, maybe other movies would have easily done that. Like, it's not just that she's making the song too poppy. It's that she's a sellout because, I don't know, she sells her body
to sell the song.
Yeah.
She's a villain because she's sexualizing it. Or something. And that's not the case here. Yeah, that's a really good point.
All right, so what grade would you give this? Like, for me, it's like a very sort of lackadaisical 7.
Okay.
Because it's like, it's, you know, it's a decent movie.
It just glides right along.
Yeah, like, I for what it is, it could be higher. But it's not, like, it's not super memorable. But the songs probably will stay in your playlist.
Yeah, yeah. I'm gonna tell you this, I'm giving it a 9. I loved it.
That's amazing.
I just found this so delightful, so charming, so... And you know what? I think also, you know, the world is a nightmare right now. And so to sit down
for... quality fluff is...
Yeah, to sit down for 2 hours and watch a really fluffy, really light, really just kind of
well
pleasant,
done.
Charming.
You know what? I think it's possible that if I had watched this for the first time, it would be a little higher because, like, the enjoyment is probably greater the first time you see it. Like, I remember loving this movie. And like I said, for what it is, it could be a 9. And it's not a weak 7. It's like a solid quality 7.
Yeah. Just like float. But yeah, I loved it. And I loved the songs. There's a little part of me where I was like, when they started singing their what's the way back to my heart song.
Way Back Into Love.
Way Back Into Love. When they start working on that song, I'm like, this is a little boring. And then the more they sing it, I'm like, I like it. the movie just kept winning me over. Despite my, I went in ready to hate it. Like, I went in, I was like, oh, I can't wait to do, like, an episode about a bad movie. This is going to be so fun. It's so fun we could talk about a really crummy movie. I was fully ready for that, and I loved it.
I love how sometimes this podcast is just, like, the chick education of AJ Knox.
Yep.
I'm just like, here you go. Does this movie need fixing? Because I feel like for me, it is mainly that, like, hey, let's, you know, take all the things that broke her into tiny pieces and poke at them. Mm-hmm. Other than that, maybe not surprisingly, I'm like, more 80s music videos. Also, it struck me, more pitches for weird nostalgia reality shows. It would be really funny if, like, either he has to go to all these bizarre meetings or just, like, the manager is, like, you know, going through his email on his actually, I love that when they're taking a picture, the sister, like, it's taking a picture and they do it with, like, a little plastic camera because it's 2007, so the iPhone isn't out yet.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but, like, if the manager is, like, going through his little flipbook of messages of, like, you know, this is, you know, like American Idol, but with remote control cars or, like, just
right, just
these weird,
super weird
nostalgia husband shows would be really funny.
Yeah,
but I don't think it needs fixing, which I know sounds weird if I didn't give it a 9 or 10, but I'm like, I will always say, like, more montages and music videos, but that's me.
Yeah, I would also agree. I think, like, the one thing I kind of wish there was a bit more of was, yes, a little bit more of the 80s. And even though Pop Goes My Heart, the music video they show, ticks all the boxes of an 80s music video, one of the things that kind of irked me a little bit about it was it is so clearly trying to be an 80s music video, and there's things about it that are not quite there. Like some of, like, the hazy filters and some of the transitions, like, it's just missing. I wanted somebody from, like, maybe even somebody from, like, Tim and Eric Awesome Show Great Job or something, where they're really good at replicating, like, 80s VHS. You know, I feel like if they brought in a specialist in that kind of weird,
they needed like Catherine Burns, who did the choreography for Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, because she nails, like, just the feel of the whole thing. Like, because, yeah, you want, like, the sort of hazy filter, dark room, single spotlight, backlit, sitting on a tall stool video
for Meaningless Kiss. Exactly. I just wanted a little bit more of the 80s, because so much of it was about how he was essentially kind of a one-hit wonder with pop. And I just wanted more of that.
It would have been really cool if they'd done a 90s music video from his solo album, where it's so clear that he cannot do this.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, that's it. Or more of the sister. I think those would be my two fixes. more of the things I love the most about this movie.
Yeah, because for Make It Weird, it's funny that this is one of the movies where we're like, meh, meh. Because I think this is a pretty good level of weird. Like, the music and the Cora.
She's a plant. And she's the plant woman,
and she waters
it's the weirdest meat cute.
She waters the plastic plants, and, like, it's funny because you want to know who, what's her name, Jane with the plants, is she, like, an old lady? Does she also work at the weight loss place? Like, I'm very curious about that. What the only thing I could think of is, like, maybe if Cora changed her sort of life philosophy even more often, and they had to, like, do, you know, two or more different remixes per day in this one week. So, like, suddenly it's, you know, super Tibetan or Bhangra dancing or klezmer, because she finds, like, Kabbalah, or whatever Scientology sounds like, you know, like, because it would just be funny, again, to play with the genre so that you hear, like, eight different versions of Way Back Into Love. Because I think that might also make that very pared down piano version at the end would be even sweeter, because by that point you would have almost forgotten what it actually sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear all these, like, all right, so this is what it sounds like, you know, with an accordion or whatever she's whatever guru she's met that day.
Yeah, I like that. My make it weird is literally to Rickroll every piece of music in this movie. Because I was just like, it's 80s.
Okay.
And so if every time they play a song, every piece of music you hear from pop, every piece of music is...
just slowly just turns into or starts... And it that would also, like, just structurally be, like, so the first time it's funny. Second time it's funny. Third time you're like, I get it. Fourth time you're annoyed. Fifth time you're like, okay, maybe it's a little funny. And then sixth time you're just, like, peeing your pants.
And at the end when they do their big song at the concert.
Yeah. Okay, I'm 150% here for that.
Because I was like, it's just so 80s. Let's just Rickroll this movie.
I love it. That gets a 10 from me. Did we learn anything from this movie?
Oof. I learned that music is good, but music and lyrics are better together forever. I always forget to prepare what I learned.
Well, I think sometimes we learn as we talk.
Yes.
The real ending of the podcast was inside us all along.
There it is.
I didn't learn anything. I'm just going to go listen to this music again.
There you go.
Yeah. We'll be back next week, and we will be talking about She's All That, and I cannot wait.
Oh my god, I'm so excited. I have not seen it since it came out.
And we are, like, basically contemporaries with it in the sense that we were that age that they are when it came out. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast if you're not already subscribed. Like us in all the places. Leave a review. I've seen one or two reviews. They made me very happy on it's the Apple Podcast thing.
Apple Podcast.
It's not iTunes anymore.
No.
Tell a friend about the podcast. Feel free to let us know what movies you think we should be doing, etc. Show notes are at theincomparable.com/chickflickfix. We are chickflickfix on Twitter and Instagram. We'll be back next week when I may or may not take off my glasses and shake out my hair. Say goodbye, AJ.
Goodbye, AJ.